Welcome to the Dauntless Grace Exchange. I'm Deidre.
And I'm Megan, and could not be more excited to bring back our guest, Jenna Reimersma, who was on episode 74. If you want to go back and listen to that, that'll provide like a really, really good foundation to what we're going to talk about today. But for your official bio, Jenna Reimersma is a popular author, speaker, and certified internal family systems therapist whose groundbreaking IFS books have repeatedly topped Amazon's best-selling new release charts. A Harvard graduate, seasoned clinical director, and dynamic presenter, Jenna speaks to audiences across the globe, offering compelling and innovative solutions to the most challenging mental health issues of our day. And I think the last time we were here, we were talking a lot about your book, Altogether You, but now we get to talk about the new book released this past summer, Altogether Us. So welcome, Jenna. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be with you.
We were thrilled that you said yes. We just, your podcast episode is very well received by so many people, including us, and the way it's impacted us. So thank you for your time again. And thank you for the offering of this book. I would love to let you share with our listeners a little bit more about this, because to be honest, I haven't read all 400 and some odd pages yet, but we're working through it. It's a beautiful treatise of all of the professionals that you've pulled together in such a collaborative way. So,
yes, I'd be glad to. So the book really emerged from my consultation groups where I train clinicians. And I do a lot of integration work, integrating the IFS model with a variety of other models and topics. And realized I was answering a lot of the same questions over and over and over again. And so as soon as I started to begin to write things down, I realized that a true integration book needs to come from the voices of the collective. Mm-hmm. And so I started reaching out, and long story short, we have over 50 contributors to this book. It's almost 700 pages long, and it is a fairly comprehensive kind of Bible of bringing IFS into areas of our lives and types of therapy in really practical ways. Every chapter is a standalone chapter, and it talks about critical things like IFS and the Enneagram, which I know you love, and IFS and sexuality, IFS and addiction, IFS and parenting, IFS and adoption, IFS and polyvagal theory, IFS and sexual orientation, gender identity, using and embodying IFS with a variety of traditionally marginalized clients. And so it is a broad, very application focused offering so that people can pick it up, turn to the chapter they're interested in, read a quick, you know, really comprehensive, applicable chapter. And then we've got lots of appendices and tear outs that people can take away and go apply it immediately. So I'm thrilled. We've just been so privileged to have a wide variety of authors, including Dr. Richard Schwartz, the founder of Internal Family Systems, who wrote our first chapter and has continued to be just such a mentor and friend and encouragement to me as he's brought this model to the world. So that's Altogether Us, and it's available on Amazon or wherever books are sold.
I have the Kindle version, so I didn't even realize it was 700 pages. I knew it was lengthy because I've flipped through the contents. I've read just a handful of chapters right now, but I think that's why I like it. It's presented more of like, almost like a medical Bible, right? Like it's kind of like, okay, here's your reference book. And now which chapter do you need to read right now? Or which chapter, like you said, is applicable for the situation. And I'm not a clinician. I'm not working with clients, but I can go, okay, in my own life, I know that the embodiment work of IFS is something that I really need to focus on. Who did Jenna bring in to say about that? Or, you know, to say about that. And so I've read the polyvagal chapter, the Enneagram chapter, a few of the other ones that you mentioned, but I love that you've compiled it all in such a way that it's for clinicians, but it's also accessible for the lay people like me.
Absolutely. And one thing that felt really significant and important to me was that this also be a piece that would feature and amplify traditionally marginalized voices. And so we have a large section on intersectionality. We have some amazing authors who have contributed. And we also are donating a percentage of the proceeds of the book sales to the Foundation Fellows Scholarship that provides IFS training and leadership development for individuals from traditionally marginalized communities. So it's really a passion of mine as I compiled and published and edited and wrote parts of this book, that it really get back all the way around, that it really be a resource that would be an encouragement and a bridge. I'm excited to have it out in the world.
That's beautiful. I think that's why I felt like saying thank you for the offering of this gift, because it's not for you to make money. It's not for your name to be known. It is to really elevate so many different people and the contributors to this. So that is, and the fact, like Megan said, that we can use it as lay people in a meaningful way, really goes, I think Megan and I both kind of geek out about smart people, and we'd like to think that we are, but let's be honest, there's a lot of great minds in the world, and we just like to glean from all of that. It's so powerful. I think what we would like our listeners to know is we've been doing a trauma series, and we're not discontinuing that actually in this conversation, but we are using this to bridge to a new conversation, specifically in your work, I think on the last episode that Megan mentioned you were with us, we talked a little bit about moving toward the parts of ourselves with curiosity, compassion, but also toward others. And then as we pull back at a little bit more of a macro level, like moving toward communities that, as you say, were maybe traditionally marginalized or have suffered a generational trauma, right? And getting more understanding around that. And so especially after this book has been released and hearing your heart in some of those authors that were chosen and some of the topics that were developed in there, I just would love to kind of let you loose to talk about that a little bit more.
Absolutely. I love how IFS is so profound as a way of experiencing and healing not only ourselves, but the world, that it can bridge these contexts from our own interpersonal and intrapersonal trauma to systemic and group and regional and national and political and sociological trauma. And the way that it does that is because the principles that it embodies are universally applicable. So IFS lets us know that we all have this core, undamaged, essential inner self that many faith traditions have a word for. In Christianity, we might call it the God image or the Imago Dei. In Hinduism, we call it Atman. In Buddhism, we call it the Buddha nature. Whatever word we might attach to it, it is inside of every human being, and it is fundamentally undamaged, no matter how much trauma we may have experienced. And we all have a system of parts that make us who we uniquely are. And all of our parts are good, but when they encounter trauma, they become burdened. And those burdened parts get stuck in some unhelpful roles. And it's that core that can help unburden them. So it really sees our inner worlds as a system. And the solution to the pain and suffering of our inner experience is to help our burdened parts have an attachment repair experience with that core God image or core inner self that IFS would call it, so they can be unburdened and restored to their original positive essence. And we can take that model of the interior core self and parts, and we can apply it then to external systems. So we can use it to look at, let's say, political parties. Let's say nations that are at war with each other, or let's say racial dynamics. And so, for example, in the United States, we have this incredible trauma of intergenerational racial trauma, oppression and marginalization of individuals with many different people groups, but particularly the legacy of slavery and oppression of individuals of African descent. And so we look at the trauma that has occurred that our culture is holding. And so we have white-bodied individuals and BIPOC individuals, and we have these groups that are holding this free-floating cultural trauma. And what we find is that we can see burdened parts playing themselves out. We can see denial. We can see aggression. We can see control. We can see marginalization in the dominant culture playing themselves out, which are burdened parts of the collective that are replicating trauma with a group that is carrying burdens from historic racism and legacy burdens. And so what we tend to do is move against the parts of others that frighten us, that we don't like, or that we feel uncomfortable with. And we can see that if you just sort of turn on CNN or look at our political discourse, people who don't look like us, people who don't have the privilege that we have, people that are marginalized, we tend to move against them. In many profound and damaging traumatic ways that replicate these systemic traumas. And the answer is to move toward those parts of ourselves that are engaged and holding the burdens of racism, of oppression, of marginalization, and unburden them and unburden the collective, which is a tall order, so that we can then, from the authentic essence of our group, offer authentic ownership and repair to begin to alter the trajectory of these generational burdens that are being held by these different groups. And I realize for people who may be newer to the model, I may have completely lost a lot of our listeners, but the idea that we are systems, we operate as systems inside of ourselves and also outside of ourselves. And the answer is to begin inside of us to heal the parts of us that carry the burdens of oppression and racism so that we can then turn toward people groups that have been harmed and marginalized to begin to engage in authentic healing and repair.
Not to put you on the spot, but do you think it's ever the responsibility of the marginalized group to move toward the other? Or does the work always need to start with the dominant culture moving towards the marginalization?
Yeah, so I'm a white-bodied person that that carries a lot of privilege. So I don't even know that it would be appropriate for me to give voice or pretend to give voice to what would be right for a group that has been marginalized. But what I do know is that for people who are white-bodied and carry privilege like myself, it is incumbent on me. It is incumbent on us to take a U-turn, as we say in IFS, and really do our anti-racist, our anti-biased work to unburden the parts of ourselves that hold that. And I, you know, there's so many ways to do that. Resmaa Menakem, somatic abolitionism, there's just so many beautiful ways to do that incredibly important and difficult work. It's very courageous work. And it starts with those of us who hold privilege, because we cannot show up in authentic and truly healing ways if we're showing up out of parts. Maybe parts that want to over-identify or over-rescue marginalized communities, or who may have a savior kind of a mission. You know, these are well-intentioned but burdened parts. And the way that we can truly begin to heal these enormous burdens that our culture carries is to begin by taking our own U-turn and doing our own work so we can bring a critical mass of our own inner self energy to the work.
It's so important to do this inner work. You just laid that out like an unbelievable treatise on why this is so important, because all of this inner work that is not dealt with begins to project out into compounding trauma in the family system, which is where it began anyway, right? But then in the societal context, you used a phrase a minute ago about the rupture repair. And I'm not sure I'm saying it exactly like you did, but I wanted to just unpack that a little bit. I know we've talked here a little bit about even in some parenting things, like the repair of the rupture is so important in any relationship, but especially like for a parent to come back to a child and say, I lost, you know, I lost my temper. That wasn't right, but it wasn't your fault. Like that takes a big burden off the child because they're telling themselves a story about that. But I think about, as you were just describing that, how that applies in so many contexts, internally and externally in this. So just wanted to get a little more, dig into that a little bit.
Absolutely. I think very similar principles apply, that it starts with our own U-turn and owning the parts of ourselves that have been complicit in causing harm, and doing our due diligence in knowing the history of the harm that the harmed party is carrying. And so that when we're in a parenting moment, that may just simply be the last 20 minutes. When we're in racial trauma, that is the work of people who have been holding positions of privilege to educate ourselves on the legacy of trauma. And that is easy to avoid, because it is easy when we are in a privileged body to not ever have to encounter that. It is easy to arrange our lives in such a way that we don't have to experience the discomfort. And that's not a privilege that traditionally marginalized communities hold. They are constantly having to encounter that discomfort. And so it's really incumbent on us to do our due diligence, and then also to show up in ways that are truly led by our authentic self, that are accountable, that take ownership without blame shifting, without excuse making, and that sincerely hold space for whatever the response is. Mm-hmm. And I know in my own encounters with repair, when I have caused harm, it is my work to sit with my own discomfort. If the person is not willing or able to receive my offer of repair, for example, and it brings up a lot of angst for me. You know, I want to be okay. I want us to be okay. I want to feel like a good person who did the right thing. And that's my work to do. Those are my parts that are coming up. And it's a very deep topic, and I'm certainly not an expert to really even be able to wade very deeply into it. But the beauty is we have a whole variety of authors who really are experts, who have written our entire intersectionality section in Altogether Us, who've really helped to unpack, for those of us who may be newer and less familiar with some of these dynamics, what it is like to be in the world in positions that have less power, that are traditionally oppressed and marginalized. And it's really a beautiful and a powerful section of the work.
Two somewhat related comments to that. The first is, Deidre and I have talked on this podcast, we've had a couple episodes in the last few years about conflict styles. And I know that my go-to from burdened places before I ever knew IFS is, when I'm in conflict, I need to apologize so fast that I'm not even really taking responsibility. I just really need your reassurance that we're going to be okay. And so yeah. I'm putting the burden of responsibility to make it okay on the person I harmed with whatever I did in the first place. And so that's something that, like, you know, just to throw an example, was it just yesterday or the day before, Deidre said, hey, when you said this, I felt this way about it. And I was able to just go, I'm so sorry. And instead of having all these parts just run around and try to protect me, I could just hear that. And so that's been a huge work of IFS. And I think that's what you're talking about, when we can let those protectors just kind of stand back and let that God image lead. We don't have to react in such a posture of defensiveness, like, oh, I got that wrong, so I need to protect myself and show them. The second story goes to what you were saying specifically about, like, in terms of reaching out to marginalized communities and getting that wrong sometimes and being willing to listen. I did like maybe a 20-minute LinkedIn learning course yesterday for my work, and it was just on bias. And one of the questions we had to answer on the quiz was, like, if you say something wrong, how should you respond? And the question was, like, tell them what your intention really was, be defensive, or say you're sorry and listen. And I thought, it's as simple as that. But our default is always to get defensive or to, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean that. Let me tell you what I really meant by it. You heard it wrong. You took it wrong. And that's putting the burden then of the responsibility onto the wounded person, as opposed to, it might have been an innocent mistake, but why can't I own that and then let them tell me how and why and how not to do it again in the future? So yes. Those are just two quick examples to tell you, like, it's so simple and so hard.
It's really beautifully said, Megan. The reflexive response to protect, to self-protect, is very strong. And that's true, I find, whether we're in a rupture with someone over a racial aggression, or in a rupture with a partner, or in parenting, or a neighbor. There is a reflexive response to self-protect that prevents us from connecting at a heart level. And it is a learned skill to be with the part of us that wants to show up and assert our intention. But that's not what I meant. But you didn't. But we should have, you know. And to help that part develop a healing relationship with the God image inside of us, so that when those conflicts arise, even if we can't do it in the moment, we can take a time out and come back with being led by the God image inside of us and say, you know what, I did this and it hurt you and I'm so sorry. Will you please forgive me? I am absolutely here and available if there is anything you'd like to share about how that was for you. And is there anything else that I can do to make this right?
It's interesting that you use the word connection, because actually in our last episode where we were talking about polyvagal theory and kind of how that relates to IFS work, like when we are in that central vagal place, we ventral vagal, like we actually have the opportunity for connection. But as soon as anything gets us into that hyper, you know, or hypo aroused space, or that sympathetic or dorsal space, we step out of that ability to connect. And so with IFS language, it's like those protector parts, or in attachment language, it's like, you know, I want to retract, or I want to grab hold, I'm anxious, or I'm avoidant, or whatever. And this is when now there's no connection happening. And so how do we do repair work if we're not connecting, and it's only our parts kind of butting up against each other, or our trauma responses hitting each other? But we have to do our own work to know when we've gotten out of that space that is open for connection, when there's somebody else driving the bus and not our core self, you know, like that is so important, because we can't know if somebody else is in a connecting place. We can only know our own space. And if we're there, I mean, I think actually we kind of can know what's coming at us from somebody else. We can sense if we're being open to or fought against, but we can't do anything about it. We have no control over them, but we do have control over our own reactions and responses. And it's just, I don't know, it just all feels like Megan said, so simple, but so hard, because it is reflexive. I don't want to put you on the spot and be like, what is the one thing we can all do? Because I know this is such complex work, and probably it's what you've already shared with us, like take the U-turn, move toward. Maybe just what are some warning signs that we could share with our listeners that are like, you know, that you're not repairing, or you're not hearing, or you're not moving toward when?
Yeah, so I'm having memories of some of my, you know, big misses that are just coming to mind. And I've just, you know, learned a lot through making a lot of my own mistakes. And I still am very much on my journey of learning. But for me, one way that I can notice is when I'm flooded, and I am taken over by fear, or sadness, or shame, and my protective parts want to jump in and manage the situation to try to create either the image of something or perception of something, or to be in control in some way, to force the situation to resolve so that I feel better. Yeah, I'm trying to take care of my flooding exiles. And I know for me, that is definitely a warning, is when I get flooded. And what my my growth edge is stepping away when I'm noticing I'm starting to flood, and giving myself a moment so that I can take a U-turn and help my parts that are flooding and taking me over to calm down, so that I can come back and say, wow, I really made a miss there. Is there anything you'd like to share with me about that? I'm so sorry. Would you please forgive me? Is there anything else you need from me around this? And I'm open to hearing your perspective. And that is a place of connection. Like if you think about, I don't know, the last time you might've been in a conflict with someone that you cared about, if they had come to you and said that, like, it takes all the energy out of the, you know, out of the conflict. It's like, oh, connection opens up that heart space, that spaciousness, that ventral vagal energy of connection, which is so beautiful. Yeah. And that's where the healing happens. We heal in connection, in community.
Mm-hmm. Because honestly, the trauma came from the disconnection somewhere. Right. And so it, unfortunately, everything in us is like, no more connection. That's scary, but it's exactly what we need. And if we think about that at the societal level, like the trauma came because of what we did to one another in close proximity. And the only way it can heal is coming back in some way together for the connection. But all these defenses and things stand in, and actual fences stand in the way of that happening. The implications are really powerful.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I think that just the whole concept of moving towards versus moving against, which I believe is the heart of the IFS model, it gives us an entirely different lens with which to view, and I think much more hopeful lens with which to view sort of the future and how do we heal the divides in our country. And when we have a move against, which is a parts led energy, we tend to think of who's right and who's wrong, who's going to win and who's going to lose. Mm. It's got a very polarized energy where we're trying to one up and win. And it's very dividing. We dehumanize whoever is on the other side of the divide from us. And we have to defend our rightness with everything that's in us. And that's kind of a hopeless battle because we will continue to diverge until we no longer can find anything that we even remotely agree on, and we've lost all human connection. And moving toward really takes a lot of courage. And move toward, it's important to underline, doesn't mean anything goes. Yeah. So we move toward our own parts with curiosity and compassion so that we can get access to that God image inside of us. That's step one. We have to move toward our own parts before we can wisely and effectively turn toward other people's parts.
Yeah.
So there's step one and step two. So if the person or the political party or the whomever on the other side of the equation is in fact harmful, mm-hmm. is dangerous, is doing something that is unjust or unrighteous, we can most effectively move toward our own parts before we turn toward that with wisdom and discernment, because only the God image inside of us has the ability to view what's happening with clear discernment and to speak with courageous advocacy without coming from a place of hatred and division. And that is a very difficult, very emotionally advanced skill, to advocate for justice and righteousness from a place of love and not hatred. And so few people in the history of the world have ever been able to do that, that you and I can, their names are already at the top of all of our heads because we all know who they are, because it is such a rare thing that we can count them on one hand. Mm-hmm. To be able to turn toward an enemy, so to speak, or someone who is harmful, and speak into that and ask for accountability and justice, but not out of a place of hatred and division. It's extraordinary. And it's an act of profound courage. And it is what I think our the Christendom and all true faith traditions actually invite us into.
When you were explaining just the how we tend to polarize and want to other people so much, it's totally fear-based. It's 100% fear-based. everything we do is out of self-protection. I think that's just, that's our motivator. Whatever that protection is, we know that different motivators for different Enneagram numbers, and we could go through all nine if we wanted, but it's always a self-protective mechanism. And when you said it takes an act of courage to do the work first and then move towards, I was like, absolutely, because that's the only thing that's going to conquer the fear that is what's based in that polarization.
Yeah. And I love that you're really articulating that. And I would maybe even take it a step further. It is not conquering of the fear, but it is actually healing of the fear. Because what we're doing, the part of us that's afraid is activated. And by moving toward that part and bringing it into relationship with our inner self, that Imago Dei inside of us, we're actually healing and transforming and caring for our own fear before we attempt to move forward. And if we're trying to step into the dialogue in a place of fear or defendedness or rage or attacking or denial or blame shifting, all of those are only going to make the pain worse. But if we can care for the parts of ourselves that are afraid, or biased or whatever it is, then we can help them to get into healing relationship with our core. We can then lead with the God image inside of us, which can see the God image in everyone else and see through their burdened parts to the God image at their core. So we're not defeating our fear or overcoming it. We're actually befriending it and healing it so that we can stand with that strength and courage when it is required.
IFS 101. We're still learning. It's so true.
I probably would have said it better in a ministry setting.
No. It's beautiful. I'm so glad that you shared that because it is so counterintuitive.
Yeah.
It is literally the opposite of what we ever, it's so not our natural response. Mm-hmm. Everything in us moves against. Yeah.
I actually was thinking as you were talking about it, being hopeful to think that there could be change through this model, because I have been so discouraged that there's any hope that any change can come through the political landscape. Not that I'm alone in that. I think most of Americans would say that, but it's because that system is built on power and who's in and who's out and who gets the vote and who gets to stay and who has all of those things. And so the system is broken, even if the people within it might have like go in altruistically. The system does not allow for moving toward. It just is very, it is the epitome of polarization. And so I think as individuals, as we can do our work, the system will get changed, but we have to start, it's like a grassroots effort, right? It's like on the boots on the ground, like where there is relationship, where there is a real person with a real name that's sitting at the table with you, you know, that's very different than always having this, well, if we vote the right people in, they'll fix it. But the system, even if they were the right person, the system doesn't allow for that. So we have to do so much unbundling from inside and ground up, I think, to even get to the point where there's any hope that someone else could do the work for us. Someone else can't do the work for you internally, and someone else can't do the work for you relationally. And even like, we can't vote someone in to fix our social problems either. Like, we have to do this work. I don't know why I'm speaking so passionately about something I have no knowledge of, but I'm seeing it like what you're talking about on this interpersonal level. Like, it plays out at this grander level. And we just want to excuse ourselves from it and think that if we cast the vote for the right person, that somehow that's our job done, you know?
Well, the beauty of the system is that in a less burdened sort of global state, it is profoundly relational, and it is built on this respectful dialogue and discussion between opposing viewpoints to come to a place of compromise. Yeah. And there's been an infection that has created this intense polarization that we can begin to disinfect. We can begin to uninfect, because it is an outgrowth of our fear, really. Mm-hmm. The system itself encourages dialogue and debate and compromise, and connection and centrism.
Yeah.
And fear infects that system and polarizes it. And we become afraid of each other and afraid of dialogue and afraid of disagreement, because the only way we're seeing it handled is through weaponization. Mm-hmm. And understandably that we would have parts that would be afraid of that. The hope is that we can be with those parts of ourselves that feel that fear and our protectors that come in, if you're like me, with hopelessness that just don't even want to hear it. They're like, I can't even listen. Yeah. I have protectors that just want to shut it out and think, well, we're beyond repair. And the gift is, those are my trailheads. Those are the places I can start to take my U-turn and bring this reparative energy to my own parts who've become infected. Such that I no longer am drawn toward candidates who would promote that polarization, where I can vote from my authentic self, from my God image, not a burdened part that is burdened trying to protect me from fear by pulling me into an extreme camp. Yeah.
Oh, will you remind me what your Enneagram number is?
I'm a one.
Okay, I thought that, but I couldn't remember for sure. I couldn't remember between you and Allison Cook who was the three and who was the one. but no, sorry, I just wanted to hear that in the frame of how you were saying things, but it makes a lot of sense.
She's done a little more inner work than I have as a one, because I'm like, I want to go fix it. Never mind. Hopeless. I cannot.
Yeah. It's beautiful because it gives us hope that the hope can begin here.
Yeah,
we have the power to begin the change, and it's an immediate change. When I turn on the news, what comes up in me, and can I notice it? Can I ask it what it needs me to know about itself and what it needs from me to feel a little more cared for, so that I can re-engage with the larger community around me from a place of more spaciousness and more connection, more ventral vagal energy. And a whole lot comes up in me when I turn on the news. So I have plenty of work that I need to do there. Yeah.
It's exhausting, but so is burrowing and avoiding.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we should just be calling our podcast, like rebranding it to just call it like, Do Your Own Work First. Because I can't even tell you how many conversations we've had where it just comes down to like, but you have to do the work. You've got to be willing to do the work. And if you're not going to do the work, then so many other things, like, I don't know, I was just on a podcast with somebody else's and I said, we can do really good things in the world as good people. And we can do a lot of good things in the world as Christ followers. But if we're not willing to do our internal work, the work that we're doing out in the world is going to have less impact than if we're willing to do the work inside first. Mm-hmm. And I just think we can't change systems of oppression on a macro scale if we haven't done our own work on a micro. And I don't know how to make everyone care about this as much as we care about this, except to just keep talking about it.
Yeah, I love your hearts. I love what you're doing and how you're inviting people into that conversation in such courageous ways. And the great news is that at the end of the day, it benefits us when we do our own work, because when we are in a constant state of fight or flight and fear and rage and aggression or denial and shutdown, we're in adrenal overload and we will hit a wall, and our bodies are carrying that, and we're going to have sleep disruption and, you know, irritable stomachs, and our lower backs are going to give out, and we're going to get migraines, and our bodies will let us know we're carrying all of this collective trauma. Mm-hmm. And when we do our own work and drop into that ventral vagal state and help those parts of us get into this healing connection to our inner divine essence, our body can relax out of that fight, flight, fear, freeze response and into the spaciousness that actually feels so good. It's what all of us are longing for. So there's a lot in it for all of us when we do take that U-turn and do our own work, because it heals us and it gives us the peace and the spaciousness that we are really hungering for.
Hold on to that hope, because you just described four ailments that would probably be, as a collective, Deidre and Maya's top four ailments. So
I know, I felt
I'll call the irritable bowels and the migraines. She'll take the sleep and the lower back pain, please.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, our bodies carry all of that collective trauma. How could they not? Yeah.
I feel like this ends us on a hopeful note that we have change is possible and relief is there, even though it feels a little daunting to start the work, you know? So if people are a little bit like, oh, I tried some of that stuff and now I'm just all in my feels all the time. Like, there is relief. You have to kind of work through it, but there is that spaciousness and where you can just breathe and you can not feel so pulled by all of these things that have driven you before in the past, or so exhausted by all these self-protective measures. So I appreciate that you brought that to us as a gift so a year ago, but also just in the ways that you're continuing this work and continuing to educate us. So thank you so much. And again, I know our listeners can find this on Amazon. Especially, I know we have a few friends of the pod that are clinicians and therapists themselves. I think it would be a great resource for you to have at your ready.
Wonderful. I so appreciate everything that you both are doing to really bring healing and hope to the world. And just appreciate the invitation to be here with you today.
And that wraps up another episode of the Dauntless Grace Exchange. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app and leave a review so other people can find us.
You can follow us on social media to stay connected. We're on Instagram at Dauntless Grace Ministries, and our Facebook page is Dauntless Grace.
For more about the Enneagram, visit our website at dauntlessgrace.org for coaching and training opportunities. And you can follow me at Enneagram Megan on Instagram.
And be sure to check out our website for more information about today's podcast. Plus, you can click the resources tab to find books by all the authors we've spoken to or about. And you can find it at dauntlessgrace.org.